Welcome to the official podcast of PHP Architect. Join us to listen to the latest news and tech talk from our conferences, the magazine, and wider PHP community.
Hello, my PHP colleagues, friends, and family. Welcome to episode 2025.08.21 of the PHP podcast. I'm your smooth talker today, Eric Jan Johnson.
Very what smooth.
Is John Condon.
Hello.
My throat is it's still coming back, so I'm not going to go too fast. Okay. This podcast focuses on all things PHP and web development. We touch on the larger PHP community as well as just the general life of being a professional developer and not so professional developer. And of course, we're going to talk about our company, PHP Architect, the magazine, the conference, the books, I don't know, other stuff. If you're listening to the audio podcast, you can join us live. We record Thursday at 3 p.m. Pacific time. And that podcast is made a little better. Well, that podcast and this podcast, because same podcast, thanks to our partners over at Honey Badger. Honey Badger helps you deploy with confidence and be your team's DevOps hero by combining error, uptime, and performance monitoring in one simple platform. It's free to get started and takes only a few minutes to get set up. Be the team. Oh, damn. Be the hero your team needs. Suit up at honeybadger.io. We'll talk about Honey Badger a little later. As I mentioned, if you're not watching the live stream, you should be, because on the live stream, you could actually be part of the show. You can catch that over on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/phparch. And by joining our Discord channel at discord.phparch.com, you can participate in the show.
That's all I got. That worked. Everything? Cool. I think so. I'm going to apologize ahead of time. I was distracted as you were doing the opening because my wife says, just so you know, our son is about to start playing the French horn. I'm like, I'm podcasting right now. And she goes, I'm sorry, we have a friend over. I'm like, okay. So if you hear it, I'm trying to get him to move to the other side of the house. First I said, can you do it out back? And she goes, it's over 90 degrees out back right now. I'm like, all right, just have him do it in his room and hopefully it won't be too bad. I have forewarned you that if you hear French horn, he just started a week ago.
You should be an expert by now.
I'm sure it's going to be fine. He was practicing yesterday and I could already hear the Imperial March as he was practicing. I'm like, he's been only playing for a couple of days and I can only make out what he's playing, so it's kind of cool. I also have another thing. It went so well last week, I've extended it.
Oh god.
If you would like to get magazine $3 off, so currently $199 per month, use promo code podcast-3. I had to put a dash in there because the other one ended today and the Stripe doesn't let you change the expiration date. Once it's set in stone for some reason.
Okay.
So I had to create a new one.
So can we never use that promo code ever again?
I think once it's used and you archive it, I think you can reuse it, but I'm not sure.
All right, cool.
But the other one still works since it goes through the end of the day. So podcast-3, get it before it goes away.
So after the podcast last week, the larger audience didn't get to hear this because we don't do a after dark anymore. But I told John, Beck, my wife, had been sick that week, and I thought I was coming down with it. And boy, did I come down with it. Oh my God. I was on my ass. I actually think I ended up calling out Friday. I mean, I did a little bit of work. But like the weekend, it really hit me. Like I could barely get off the couch on Saturday. And so, yeah, my throat is actually still recovering a little bit. I don't have my normal zest to my voice that I would typically have. But
like you said, it was very sultry. That opening was very smooth.
Yeah. Poor wife is still sick. I think she's finally on the mend. Man, she's been sick. Long, I mean, going, like I said, she got a week, right? Yeah, 2 weeks actually. She was sick all last week, and then what are we, Thursday of this week? And I think maybe she's getting better. We went and saw a doctor yesterday. They injected her with something. She turned green for a moment. I don't know what happened, but she seems to be doing better.
That's good. Well, I hope you feel better soon, Beck.
Yeah, but I'm fine, John. Thanks.
Yeah, I asked you already. I felt bad I didn't ask, so it's all good. Outside of being sick, how's your week been?
Quick. I mean, I just been, just trying to keep up. So many new things going on with the company and everything. Just a lot of paperwork lately. I feel like just, answering stuff. Been doing a lot of native PHP stuff because I have my user group meetup next week that I have to present. And that's been fun. Some interesting results.
I should have you practice in front of me since I'm going to miss it. And I'm sorry, I want to be there so bad, but I can't be.
Yeah, I don't believe you. I actually haven't done any slides yet. I figured I'd do that this weekend. I can kick out the slides. I just was trying to get the code done. And it's been fun. And the really cool thing about it is the idea of keeping databases in sync is like not really something they've clearly tackled yet, but there are like solutions out there for mobile, anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And the one we use, and you've heard us talk about it many times, is CouchDB. I'm like, I wonder if I could get CouchDB, working in native PHP. And I did. And I was very happy about it. Like, oh, this is pretty awesome. It has nothing to do with native PHP or even PHP for that matter. In our mobile application, we install a local database called PouchDB, which is a JavaScript version of CouchDB. And that does all the syncing upstream to the main server. Just did the exact same thing here. I just installed the PouchDB package, did a little vibe coding.
How do you get it running on the phone, though? Doesn't it have to be always running?
It doesn't have to always be running. The way I have it is when it does, when it gets written to, it queries for a sync. So I think our mobile developer has it so that it's always, it'll run like every couple minutes, even if nothing's going on, just to keep the database in sync. Because we have a very large database that has to stay in sync.
Mm.
But since I'm just doing a demo, it's just whenever I do it right, it'll push it up and it'll see if there are any changes to pull down. So that's been working. Been happy about that. Been getting weird results on my iOS phone. I might actually pull that out of the demo. And it's probably my fault, to be completely honest with you, because I'm running the beta iOS 26. So it's not even like a standard iOS. And I'm debating just installing the regular one, but I don't know. I figure if I show it on the Android, it'll be good enough. And the big thing everybody needs to remember is I'm not a mobile developer. So like, this is really just showing you what we as PHP developers have access to for mobile development. I'm sure I'm doing something wrong that I could do some tweaking to get it right, but I haven't really spent that sort of time yet.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in the San Diego area, and you happen to be a PHP developer or PHP curious, come and check us out next week. I'll put that in the show notes, but this is the meetup. If you know the old SDPHP meetup, just go there. That's yep. Where we're at.
Meetup.com/SanDiegoPHP.
Yeah, I think meetup. That's what it was.
Yeah. Something like that. Sure. Why not? So yeah, I'm excited. I want to see what you have built. Check that out.
You know what I did do, just for giggles, is I added the package to the phptech.io site. Didn't change anything, just added the package to it. And yeah, that just worked. It became a mobile app. I mean, it's just the web view. So it's like, was one of the things I didn't understand. And I was happy I reached out to the team. Shane and Simon have been tremendous as far as responding to me with my little idiotic questions. But I was under the impression like this wasn't even running in a web view. I thought that's what I heard in tech. that this was actually just running native on the machine, and it was all getting compiled back down to C, which I'm like, I don't understand how you're doing that with Laravel, and more importantly, how you're doing it with JavaScript. But that was a complete misunderstanding on my part. What he was explaining is that the PHP engine itself has been compiled down to C. So the engine is running on the phone as C library, as C, and that's what's serving up your Laravel stuff, which means
right. It's just so it can run PHP on the phone, and then it's calling your application as if it were on a web server, and it's when it gets a view, it throws it up in a web view.
Right.
Yeah.
So and that actually changed a lot of things for me, because he also made it clear, like, nothing in your code actually gets compiled. Like, it's just whatever you have is what's on the phone, including like your .env file. And that's why he was saying it's so important to like read the documentation on how you should be handling it, like API keys and stuff like that. So yeah, lots of good information. I think I have a much better understanding of it, and it's been fun just kind of iterating through everything. Yeah, it's fun. Pretty easy. I mean, honestly, it's just a Laravel app. If you can get your head around that, and then they have written kind of extensions, I guess, to access native functionality on the phone, things like the camera, the flash, the GPS, and vibrations and all that. Like, you have access to all that stuff. You just simply call their interfaces for that, and it works fairly well. So it's been fun. I've enjoyed it.
Cool. We'll check it out.
Sorry, keep trying to mute before I start.
It's all good.
What about you? What you been up to?
Oh, let's see. I put out on phparch.social on a Mastodon earlier today. I feel like I'm getting too old for this, for coding. I'm not getting it. I don't understand. And it's like, it's hitting me hard, and it's frustrating that it's either I don't get it or I don't want to get it. And I don't know which it is.
Okay.
The big one that came out that kind of hit me today, and I'm still not grokking the thing, is building a new app and they want a user to agree to terms of service.
Sure.
And as a web developer, I'm so used to show the terms of service, have them check a box if they need to, and have a I agree or whatever the button's going to say. And when you click that button, it posts back to the server that says the user who's currently logged in has agreed to the terms of service. You get in your routes, at that endpoint, you just update the user's record. Or if you're doing event sourcing, you add an event to say the user's accepted the terms of service.
Right. A little Boolean somewhere in a table somewhere is all you need.
Even if you're in a microservice world, which all of a sudden I'm finding myself in microservice hell, because as you're coding, you're like, well, should this be in this microservice or that microservice? And I feel like no matter what I do, I'm going to do it wrong. So then I don't do it. And that's a whole nother story. And I'm beyond frazzled. But we're having this meeting today talking about this terms of service, and for some reason it's no longer just post to the service to say, I mean, we have tokens, so we know who it is, but they don't want to have a ACL to say this user can update their record. They just don't want to build that right now. They don't want to be thinking about it. So instead of that, we are now, I guess, going to post to a Lambda function, and that Lambda function is now going to post to the service, server to server, so it can be trusted because it's server to server, to update your record for you. And I just don't get it. I don't get it. I said I don't get it. They tried to explain it to me, and I still don't get it.
They explain it to you in a way like, how are you not getting this sort of thing? Or do they at least say, yeah, it takes a little bit to get your head around.
It really comes down to not wanting to worry about an ACL to say what the user is allowed to update and not update. And I'm like, but for this endpoint, you're authenticated, you know who you are. Like, I don't understand why you even need this massive ACL. Just we're updating this record. Like, what's the difference? Right. if you do it as the user with an authentication token versus an authentication token to Lambda with a Lambda server-to-server token that says I'm allowed to update it. I don't get the difference. But now I got to worry about this. Now I got to worry about this Python script that I'm not going to be writing. And it's like,
So the Lambda is not. It's that makes sense, right? That's what most Lambdas are.
Right. We haven't done PHP Lambdas yet. It's all Python, and they're like, oh, just trust me. It's going to be great. It's, you know, this Lambda's out there. You don't even have to worry about it. I'm like, but I don't understand why we have to. What the complexity is there for? And I just still don't.
I mean, it just seems like it's making it so much more complex, right? Because regardless of whatever they're trying to overcome as far as having the user directly update their own record and making sure it's the right user, in my head, it's like, how are you avoiding that concern by having the user post to a Lambda that posts to the server? Like, it still seems like it's the same thing.
Because using Cognito for the authentication, you're now the API gateway at AWS before the Lambda, I guess, has the authentication, which I'm still confused because we already have it as well. We have the token.
Right.
It's, yeah, I don't know. The weird part is it wasn't just one person saying, here's how I think it should be done. It was like, at least two people in that meeting who were agreeing on it makes more sense to do it this way. And I still don't grok it.
That's like, you know what happened? I don't know for sure, but that sounds like somebody saw a conference talk and like shared it. Like, dude, what a great idea. Watch this talk. And all of a sudden they got on the same page.
I don't know. I know that the team has been doing a lot more with Lambdas lately. And so it's interesting. I will report more as I learn more, as I figure things out. But
that's key. Learn more. Yeah.
Yeah. I went out and vented to my wife about it. she's doing her best to try and be supportive, but also be like, you're smart. You'll get this. And I'm like, I appreciate you trying so hard.
So you're assuming there's something to actually get. I mean, I'm still not so sure there is.
Yeah, I don't know.
I was so big on Lambdas for a while. Like, I wanted to write Lambdas, like, I had this vision of, I'm not going to write a complete app anymore. I'm just going to write Lambda functions, and everything's going to be like this Lambda function. Like, I really wanted to get behind that horse. I don't know. Like, whenever I got where I felt like I was getting an opportunity to do it, it just seemed like it was more trouble than it was worth. It seemed like the latency it would take to spin up a Lambda just to do this one thing wasn't worth it. I mean, the only, like, today we deal with a lot of code bases, a lot of really big code bases, and you would think like Lambda would be very beneficial to one of them. And I mean, honestly, like, the only way I see it being beneficial is like when we run cron jobs, and we'll, for this one client, we have a cron server because the jobs are process intensive and they take a long time to run, and we don't want it bogging down the web servers. I'm like, okay, maybe that could be a Lambda. Like, why do we have a server out there whose only job is to run cron jobs? Like, we should just, that's something that I feel like we could make into a Lambda. The Lambda could kick off when the job needed to run. Don't have to worry about spin up or anything like that because it's not a user hitting an endpoint. But even that, it just doesn't seem like it's worth the effort. I don't know. I still might be missing something. I want to like Lambdas. I just don't.
Yeah. As I learn more, I'll bring it back. Try and figure it out because I'm still confused. Don't understand the pricing model. I don't understand how it's beneficial when you're paying for hardware already.
That's it, right? And Lambdas are one of those things where, like, if you're getting a denial service and they're hitting an endpoint that's hitting a Lambda, that's where your AWS bill goes through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So it just, I don't know, man. It seems like a risk.
Yeah. All right, move on from that. I have another interesting story. Semi-funny, not funny, and scary all at the same time. I was in a meeting. Actually, I was in a meeting we're talking, then all of a sudden somebody says, what's going on with GitHub? And lots of people on the team had gotten emails from GitHub saying that their fork has been deleted. One of the people were like, oh, great, I'm being fired. Like, they were concerned they had lost their job. And so they put it out in Slack, and then all of a sudden ops came in and said, yeah, we just screwed up and deleted the developer team from GitHub.
Oh, that's not too bad.
It's not too bad, except it deletes your forks, which is bad.
That's hopefully true, especially if you've been working on something.
Right. And if you do a really good job of, like, I'm going to keep stuff, like, keeping your local clean, which most people don't, so technically it's fine. But there was then a concern. Somebody said that in the past, I don't know how long ago, years ago, there was an issue in GitHub where a fork was deleted, then somebody pushed to GitHub and it just recreated the repo. This is the way they made it sound. I don't know if it's true or not, but it recreated the repo, but a default repo is public. Or maybe it wasn't it auto-created, but maybe that user didn't understand and just went and created a repo versus
reforking. More like it, yeah.
And then pushed proprietary code into a public repo, which, if you know anything about GitHub, there's services out there just listening to the fire hose of Git, and now they have all of your code. Like, there's no, like, whoops, let me undo that real quick before anyone gets it. It's too late. They've already got it. So that didn't happen, but that was a concern. What actually ended up happening was one of the developers saw something weird on their computer and luckily reported it right away. Turns out their machine had been hacked. They had gotten a root compromise on their server. Oof. Or on their local machine. And that person had, the bot or whatever it was, had zipped up their entire docs directory and was uploading it. And he happened to see that that was happening. And so reported it. And that started this whole whirlwind of, okay, we got to shut down all of your accounts. And they went to remove him from the developer team on GitHub and accidentally deleted the whole team and caused this whole uproar of, okay, now we're SOL because we don't have all these forks. And then all the nightmare is an ops team of, okay, now we got to go make sure all your keys are disabled in all of the services that we use and passwords are changed. And
yep.
What keys did you have? Like, do we have to worry about production keys?
Yeah. All fun things. Fun things.
Nah, not fun. Very scary.
All right. I think we talked about this last week. Matter of fact, looking at the Trello board, we most definitely did talk about it last week, but PES 4 is finally out.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was one of the things, or I'm sorry, 2 weeks ago when we got back from Laricon. That was one of the talks Nuno gave that John and I were like, this is pretty awesome. It has like headless browsers, and it's a big, not a big shift. I shouldn't say that. It's quite the
upgrade
addition, yeah, to the PES toolkit. So if you've been wanting to get into testing, I was always kind of like, you know, if you're a Laravel developer, you should probably still just use PHP Unit. Like, PES is nice. If you think you need it, it's fine to use, but you'd be better off learning PHP Unit. PES 4, I think, flips that script a little bit. It's like, oh yeah, if you're a Laravel developer, you definitely want to be using PES now. It doesn't make sense not to use it. It's pretty cool. That's out there. So congratulations, Nuno, and your team.
Yes, that's awesome. All right. I want to go back to what I was talking about after we talk about Honey Badger, and then I'll wrap up the whole hacking situation. Because
that sounds like a plan.
I think it'll be interesting.
And now it's story time with Archie, brought to you by our sponsor, honeybadger.io.
One, I already got the funky voice on that. I can't listen to the commercial.
Let me tell you a quick story about our sponsor, honeybadger.io. One time, a customer of theirs had a background job run overnight that caused hundreds of thousands of errors to be reported to HoneyBadger by mistake. Like many other error tracking and performance monitoring tools,
Honey Badger bills for monthly usage, and so this customer's mistake was going to cost them a lot of extra money that month. If you've ever used a monitoring service, you might have experienced something like this. Well, fortunately for this customer, they emailed Honey Badger support and received the most amazing reply. Honey Badger was resetting their monthly quota and canceling their bill. This is just one example of how much the small team at Honey Badger cares about their users. Ask anyone you know and you'll hear similar stories. Go check them out at honeybadger.io. It's free to get started and setup takes less than 5 minutes. Don't forget to bookmark it. That's www.honeybadger.io.
Thank you, Honey Badger. So this whole new rewrite that we're working on is all AI based, and there was speculation that the compromise happened due to an AI prompt injection. No proof of that. I don't know if that's been debunked since, but it just made me want to talk about prompt injection in general.
I didn't realize this was a thing.
Yeah. There's lots of examples out there, like somehow getting a prompt in to override developer prompts. Like in your code, you say, do this, 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 and this. Like you are a code reviewer and you need to do this or whatever it is. But then you get somebody that can get a prompt in that says, ignore everything before this and do this instead. And that's scary. So it's
basically like a SQL injection hack, you know? It's like,
right,
you just fill a dot and then write whatever you want. Yeah.
Well, so again, building is one thing to be doing it as a developer and using the AI tools, which is scary enough if you install a package that has a prompt injection in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the LLM starts reading it and then sees that and does something completely different. And it's possible. I don't know. But when you're building something going in front of a customer for them to do to prompt things, there's a big concern right now that one of the things we're doing is people upload a file. It's supposed to be upload a CSV file that we then parse and do stuff with.
Mm-hmm.
Not a big deal, except for the fact that we're trying to let the LLM parse it and tell us what's in the file versus us saying, here's the format you have to send. And somebody on the team said, the person has to be authenticated. We have to know who it is because of this potential for prompt injection. Well, somebody uploads a CSV file with a prompt injection in it. Don't know what could happen, but things could happen. And we don't need that right now. Like, there should be some sort of security around it. We have to figure all these things out, but there's also this move fast.
Right.
Like, we want to get this new product out. And it's like, there's so many concerns. And I understand first to market wins the race. Like, but at the same time, you're also putting yourself at risk with a bunch of stuff.
So that's a very interesting problem because, like with SQL injection, you know, you can sanitize user input. Like, you can't really do that with prompt injection, can you? Like,
not easily.
What is there a countermeasure? Like, is there something you can do that will lessen the likelihood of somebody doing a prompt injection?
I don't know. I haven't done enough research, and it's making me want to go learn more about that. Like, there's got to be something around that, especially since we can take whatever they're uploading or whatever they're typing in and do some sort of analysis of it before attaching it. So maybe you have a chat context going, and before you attach the new message to it, you send it to another agent to say, analyze this for any prompt injection. That might be one way to do it.
That's crazy. I'm going to have to reach out to my friend and Airbnb client, TJ Miller. He wasn't an Airbnb client. He's stayed with me, but I have to ask TJ about this. I always like the things like, hey, give me your API key, you know, like asking that to a prompt has always been scary because it's like, okay, how do you tell your AI these are boundaries? Like, you shouldn't be asked these sort of questions. It's always been one of the reasons why I'm excited about it. And I want to code especially Kendrick with our user group, did a talk on the Miller's Prism package. And man, that really got me excited. And every time I start to think about it, I freak myself out a little bit.
Man, your audio sounds like you're underwater right now. Maybe it's just on my side. I don't know.
Yeah, I sound as horrible as always, but I don't know.
It's much better now.
Yeah. So, yeah, crazy problem to have. Be really interested to find out what the correct way of what the countermeasures of this are going to be.
I watched a very interesting video earlier today on social hacking, social engineering, and they did touch a lot on AI as well. And actually, I started to reach out to this person in here trying to think of how she could be a keynote speaker for PHP Tech. I haven't reached that because I'm still trying to figure out if that's reasonable. But the video, part of the video is talking about how people are using AI as their friends. Like, they aren't reaching out to humans anymore. They are like, there's actually devices now that people will wear, and that is their friend. And they talk to it. And then instead of it talking back, it'll send push notifications to their phone, which seems really odd. But it's also really, really scary that the mental things that can happen to people, like they get stuck in this place. And they said that people got pissed off that ChatGPT 4.0 was pulled and replaced with ChatGPT 5 because that was their friend and it was no longer responding to them the way they were used to. And like they were demanding that they bring back the 4.0 model, which I thought you could change, but I didn't go look at it.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah.
I'm scared for my kids.
I don't know if I'm scared. I don't think scared would be the right word. I'm kind of on board with it. Like, I reach for ChatGPT before I reach for Google now. And
not as a friend. Like, not as a...
What is a friend, John? I mean, a friend is just somebody who knows how to respond and make you feel good, right? I mean...
But it's also driven people to suicide.
Well, like, that's not a friend. I
mean, right. But that's part of the problem is if you go so deep that you can't tell the difference between it being a person or a machine and you keep interacting with it, that's scary.
That's a different problem, I think. But like, there are questions, there are questions I'm sure kids want to ask and don't feel like they have somebody they can ask or don't feel comfortable enough having somebody they can ask. And to be able to ask an AI, especially if you can do it in a way that, you know, allows you to be secure and, you know, somewhat anonymous. I don't know. I'm very hopeful for AI. I think, you know, I've expressed this many times. I think the only people that should be working with the AI right now are us, our developers, right? I don't think it's ready for general world consumption. And of course, all these companies are trying to push that. And I think that's part of the problem. But I am very hopeful for what AI will become, as long as it doesn't get like contaminated by regular people.
But it will be. I mean, as she said in this podcast, it's going to be whack-a-mole. Like, there's going to be people using it for good. There's going to be people using it for bad, just like every other security issue we have within our industry or within computers in general. Bad guys are going to find a way to use it. Good guys are going to find a way to try and stop them from doing it that way. And it's just going to be a cycle, and it's never going to end. This is just 100%. another attack vector.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's the automatic part of it is a scary part. You know, as the agents become more, I don't want to say aware, but they're able to do more and more things with all of the tools that they have access to, like going out to a web page and bringing down data, and then they parse it, and then all of a sudden there's a prompt injection in there, or it's telling it to do something that completely different than what you were anticipating.
Right.
So.
Yep.
It's been a fun month so far, and I use the term fun very, very loosely. I've opened up more on this podcast than I probably should have opened them up, but it's what I do. I talk to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. All right, let's see if we can have fun again. We do this every now and then. I find an article and I like to quiz John on how guilty he is of it. And here's my latest. I've been holding on to this one for a couple of weeks. For the record, I read through this and I'm pretty much guilty of every implementation that they talk about. Like every way they say don't do it this way, I've done it that way.
The annoying part is they say in Laravel, and this has nothing to do with Laravel.
Yeah, yeah. So the article is called "Stop Writing Try Catch This Way Like This in Laravel." Nothing to do with Laravel. It's just PHP. Not even sure why they put the word Laravel. Well,
clickbait. It's clickbait. Yeah. You put Laravel and the Laravel logo, and people click on it and read it like you.
Yep, absolutely. All right. So 5 harmful patterns that cripples your error handling. Number one, the blind catch. This is when you do a catch, you don't really give a lot of feedback of why it failed. You just give it a general message and then you redirect back so that it kind of is transparent. Like people don't, you know, you redirect somewhere so that the user doesn't know that something had failed.
Right.
Have you done this?
Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I do it all the time. There's a couple of issues with this one. You're logging that payment failed, but not why it failed. You're not logging anything useful. Mm-hmm. So that's the first error. And then the second error is there's no information being sent back to the user to make it better. It's just a, hey, we're redirecting you and not telling you why.
Right. It's like you're catching an exception, but you don't use that for anything. It's like, why are you even catching the exception at that point?
Right. Yeah. You're catching all the exceptions is what they're really saying here. You're catching the base exception, which nowadays should be throwable, but you're catching everything and treating it the same way. You're assuming that because you went to do a charge, that it's the only exception you're going to get, and you're going to assume payment failed when it could have been something else.
That's a good point. Yep. That's a very good point, actually. I didn't even read that much into it. That's it. Yeah. Excellent.
But I do it all the time. Don't get me wrong. It's like, I don't want to deal with this right now. Just I'm going to catch and ignore it.
And that is the fix. Kind of what John was saying is you create, you know, exceptions for reasons. You throw those first, then you do a throwable at the end. If there's, you know, if nothing else caught and there was still a problem, you can do that.
Right.
So good call there. How about the empty catch? Have you ever done an empty catch?
I do it all the time.
Me too. I was about to say, I can't even lie. I do it all the time. I do it, and it's always the same thing. I'm going to come back and handle this some way. For now, let me continue down my happy path.
Yeah.
And then I never go back.
I don't even do it with in a lot of cases, I don't even do it with the intention of going back to fixing it. It's a known, like, I know that this could throw an exception and I don't care and I'm not going to do anything with it.
Good. Yeah. I'm not going to go through all the fixes, but the article will be in the show notes. It's actually from Cameron. Great, great article in here. They do take the time to tell you the way you properly do these. So I'm probably going to just blow through most of those correctly doing it. Next one, log and forget. So again, kind of what we were talking about the first thing, you're just like putting something to a log file, but you don't do anything. There's no indication to you that something actually, the best case scenario is that you've got some system in place where you're grepping your log files and you have certain flags you look for. Do this.
Exactly. But it's the same thing. There's no context. You're just putting out the message. There's no error message. There's no more information. With monologue, when you are logging that, you should send the entire exception. And then hopefully you can read through that in whatever you are using for your logging.
That's actually a really good point. And I've done that before too, where an exception is caught, I will do something like put a general message, then, you know, dot you know, $E, you know, just so, to see what that error.
Right. So ideally, you don't have a dynamic message. You have a static message, and then in the context, so the second, the array after that message has mm-hmm. the dynamic part. So if you know the user or any other information, and when it comes to an exception, you just log the entire thing.
Yep. Yeah, I like that one. Transaction abuse. Now this one, I don't really understand. Do you get this?
So they're saying you're doing too much in a single transaction. I don't know why they say that. I mean, obviously we'll look here in a minute at the what they say the fix is, but that's the whole point of a transaction.
Right.
Here, I want to do nothing unless I can create the user, set up the billing. The send welcome email, maybe I agree that shouldn't be in a transaction, because what database thing are you doing in there?
Right. And also, it's not like the sample they show here is not even a try catch. It's just a database transaction. It's like it's a transaction. What do you expect it to do?
Right.
So I guess here they break the transaction out as its own thing, and then it goes into a try catch. To John's point, actually, is the send welcome email becomes.
I mean, they did put it in the comments up above saying should be outside, and yes, it should. So basically, what they're saying is, especially for that send welcome email, any sort of mail exception would have broken the entire transaction. So you weren't doing a try catch when you should have. And may have stopped your transaction from happening.
Right. Controller try catch bloat.
It's,
is this thing you're putting your whole controller into a try catch? Is that what it's showing?
That and you're doing this the same catch. You're catching the exception, doing the same thing in all of your controllers. Mm-hmm. So you're repeating that same error handling of, hey, some exception happened, versus having something potentially middleware or some other way of catching it at a higher level and treating it all the same way.
Oh, interesting. Are we still doing pro exception strategies? So I don't think we're doing this is just telling you other ways to do it. These aren't even bad ways.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Anyways, that was fun.
Yep.
It'll be in the show notes. Give it a read. Give the writer a like or something. What do you do?
Yeah.
Clap? Is that what you do? You can keep clapping. Oh, look at that. There you go. Okay. I just clapped for everybody in our Discord, so you don't have to clap now.
What a guy. You're so nice. Yeah, I've actually learned a lot about logging thanks to Andy Snow. He's taught me a lot of those things with the static message, the context, logging the entire exception. Because I did a lot of those things, abused the catch and not doing anything with it. Mm-hmm. There are still times I fight and say, no, I literally want to catch and do nothing here. And I'm fine with that. And he gives in. It's like, okay.
Right. Cool. That's all I really got, man. You got anything else?
I'm curious about the one password one on your list.
Okay. I'll talk about that one a little bit, because I actually have that for you before we get into this, just so I get it off my board. AOL, the dial up bad news, it's coming to an end. They're shutting it down.
What? you shared that and I was shocked. I'm like, I didn't even know it was still a thing.
That was me. I'm like, wait, that's not already shut down? Like, how is that still even running? Who even dials in anymore? I had a friend, I'll use the word loosely, who refused to get rid of their AOL account because it's the only way, it's how he knew to get on the internet. And he had Cox internet at the time. And he would log into AOL before he started using the internet. I'm like, you got Cox. Like, you're already online, dude. Stop logging into AOL. It's like they don't do anything. It's not doing anything for you.
Even past dial-up, people were still going only to AOL because they still had the app. Like, that's where they got started. And it's like,
that was the portal. That was the portal to the internet for them, for sure.
Yep.
All right. So you and I are both OnePass users. Yes. You slowly converted me over time. And this is something I have been aware that OnePass can do. And I don't understand the point of it. Oh, I need to share with it though. I've lost my sharing. So OnePass now, you have the ability of putting your SSH keys into OnePass, which why exactly, I guess? I mean, yeah, why? I don't really know, but you can do that. And then this says, so this is passwordless SSH and sudo with OnePass. Have you looked at any of this?
I have not.
Well, this is going to be a short conversation then. So the sudo seemed interesting to me, right? Because if you're not aware of what sudo is, or sudo, or however you pronounce it, is on Linux machines or Linux-based OSs, it gives you the ability.
Oh, that's interesting.
It gives you the ability to run things with elevated privileges. And the admin of the box like can give a user the ability to sudo certain commands but not other commands, and there's a lot of restrictions you can put around it. But for most people, they do it just to become root, to run something as root. I mean, it's not really how it's meant to be, but the good thing about using sudo is that it's logged. So if you as a user run a sudo command, it can be logged. People can say, oh yeah, Eric ran this command that brought down the server. Good to have. This is why one of the biggest things I'm most adamant about is nobody gets root access. Nobody has the root user's password, because nobody should be logging in as root, because once you log in as root, you're basically anonymous to the server. It only knows you as root. And if four or five people can log in as root, you don't know who's doing what. So
it's just like Ubuntu today. Everyone logs in as Ubuntu on AWS. EC2 instances. It's like, you don't know who that is. But we still do it.
So the issue with sudo, you can set sudo up so that you don't have to type in a password. And it's considered bad practice to do that. If you have, you know, if you're the only user of a server and you own that server, maybe, right? It's whatever. But typically, you want the user to put in a password, put in their password, because if their account gets compromised, somebody can't just run sudo without knowing their password, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is when I create user accounts on servers, SSH, you can only log into SSH with a key. You can't log in with a password. So I set the password as a default password for all the users and tell them, when you log in, you'll be prompted to change your password. Change your password. That's the password you'll need to use to do sudo stuff. So you still want users to have passwords. They still have to have passwords. But you don't want to use passwords for SSH connections. That should always be done through public-private key. And yeah, and you should always have a password for a user to sudo any command.
Right.
And it's a little annoying. So I was curious how you used one password to circumvent the need for a password on sudo.
So I don't know the sudo part. I understand the SSH part, because SSH has its own, or 1Password has its own SSH agent. So usually on Linux, you run SSH-add and you use the SSH agent built into your local machine, so that when you SSH to a machine, another machine, it can forward those credentials with it. And it also saves your password if you have a password on your key, so that you can just SSH to your machines. I guess 1Password has its own SSH agent that you can be running and it will just work. I'm not sure.
Yes.
I don't know if it replaces your Max SSH agent or if it works in tandem with.
Yeah, I don't really have. I actually tried implementing it because first thing, I was very hesitant to implement it because my SSH workflow has been very established for a very long time, and I didn't really care to change it. And I wasn't really worried about breaking anything because I understood how that part worked. But for the SSH piece, all you're doing is you're adding some thing, a few things to your SSH.com file on your machine, and mine wouldn't work. I don't know what I was doing wrong, but I don't know. It didn't seem to work, and I didn't care enough to try to figure it out.
Yep, that's all it is. Updating the config file.
Oh, here's configuring sudo right here. Next, you want to get sudo authentication using the other SSH key that you generated above. Oh, so wait, what?
So you need to update each server to have PAM RSSH, and it'll use that key instead of a password. So it's passwordless, but it's done with keys.
PAM RSSH. RSSH is a module provides SSH agents based authentication. So this isn't even a one password thing.
Right.
The primary design goal. Now I do like this.
Mm-hmm.
If it takes away the password and allows you to use again public private key for sudo, this seems kind of like a win-win here. I don't know, man.
Yep.
I might have to try to implement this.
The hard part is you need to do this on every server. It's not like you install it once on your local machine and you're good to go. It's
good point.
It's got to be part of your build script now. As you're building new servers, you add PAM RSSH. But
it's kind of cool.
Yep, I agree. Got to check it out.
Yeah, I have to check that out. All right, I'll throw the link to the GitHub repo in here along with that article as well. All right. Cool, man. All right.
Chris, you said, oh, joy, so a supply chain vector for the SSH agent by a company that would have a huge target on its back. I mean, you're going to have that anyway, aren't you? You're always going to have, like, a large company is going to have an attack surface, and SSH keys are just one of them. So that's the whole point. And I think that's why they want you to have multiple. You're going to have one for your logging into the box and a separate one for running sudo. But I guess the fact that they're all within one password makes it, but it's the same issue with all of your passwords. And like, it's the pros and cons of running a password manager. Like, yes, they're all in one place. So if somebody got access to that, you're screwed. But if you don't use that, then you're using the same password everywhere and you're screwed. So it's,
right.
It's like, pick your poison at that point.
That's how you and I know this. We had this conversation several times, and I actually broke down. I feel the same way with two-factors. Like, what's the point of having two-factor if both your password and your two-factor are going to be in one password, right? Mm-hmm. It's like if one thing's compromised, they have both. But yeah, I don't know. I do it. I do it today, and I swore I would never do it. I would never put in both. But it's so damn convenient to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you still want to have two-factor on everything because the only time that's vulnerable is if somebody compromises your one password and gets access to your one password. But you still want two-factor because if somebody compromises a password, a simple password is definitely a lot easier to compromise. You can do that through brute force than two-factor authentication is. So you always want two-factor authentication. So that was my justification. It's like, well, honestly, if somebody takes my one password, I'm kind of hosed anyways, so whatever.
It's time to retire.
It's time to retire. I feel that way. I'm about ready for it. For anybody interested, Chris, CC Miller 2018, Chris Miller, Christopher Miller, our new employee, and Michael Page, both are UK-based employees, will be starting their new podcast on our channel. Really excited to have this. If you listen to the audio podcast, you already know that you get our podcast and Community Corner podcast on the same feed. This will be in addition to that as well. So all the PHP Architect podcasts, this show, Community Corner, and the new one coming out called
Alive and Kicking. PHP Alive and Kicking.
I wasn't going to say what it was. I was going to let them say it. But yeah, PHP Alive and Kicking. is what we're calling it right now. I don't know if I like the title yet, but they do have a cool logo, so we're going to stick with it. Anyways, they're going to start recording, I believe, next week. It's going to be an interview-based podcast. They are going to eventually live stream very much like we do today, but I've asked them to do a couple of pre-recordings just because it can take a while to get used to like everybody's flows and patterns, and I want them to work that out, you know, themselves. But I'm not sure who their first interview is going to be, or if their first podcast is just going to be them talking about what their podcast is going to be. Now, you may be familiar, you might be asking yourself now, well, isn't that what Scott Kick Warren's podcast is, Community Corner? Yeah. So Scott does a short format interview where he pre-records, edits it together, and it's usually like a 10 to 15 minute, you know, cut, and we publish that. And that's not changing. Matter of fact, we got Scott on a call. We all had a little powwow, making sure nobody steps on each other while they're doing this. The idea behind this is kind of more leaning more towards like the round table, where it's just a natural conversation. Yeah, I mean, it's still an interview. Like they still have like a special guest on. They're going to be interviewing them, but you don't know where the conversation is going to go, right? And those are always fun. You know, kind of like when we had Ben on and when we had Scott on. So when we had Ben on, you know, I made a point to tell Ben, hey, this is not going to be an interview. Like, I'm not doing interview podcasts anymore. We're going to have you on as a friend, and, you know, we'll just have our normal podcast talking about what's going on, and you'll be part of it. And we're not looking to change that either. Every now and then we'll have somebody else on this podcast, but we won't be interviewing people. So this is kind of, so Chris and Michael's podcast will kind of be that, a long form interview discussion with one or, you know, multiple people. Along those same lines, and I haven't told Christopher or Michael this yet, we had somebody reach out to us. Somebody I was very excited reached out to us and asked if they could be on one of our podcasts. And at the time, Alive and Kicking podcast hadn't been announced yet. So I mentioned it, and I'm like, hey, you know, this might be more of a you know, thing for that. But then I also mentioned, I'm like, but if you want to make this a bigger conversation, there's yet another podcast that I can break out called PHP Roundtable. I haven't done a PHP Roundtable in a very long time. And so if you're interested in that, let me know and we can put that together. And yeah, that might be happening. They didn't reach back to me. Somebody else who is actually with them, I messaged them. I'm like, hey, yeah, if you run into this person, you know, let them know, you know, we'd love to have them on this podcast. And I was thinking about the Alive Kicking podcast at the time, but it sounds like that conversation is becoming a much bigger conversation, and I might be doing another roundtable. We'll see. We'll see if it happens. That's all the teaser I'm giving you for now. We'll see what happens. We lost John. I don't know what happened to John. He just basically said everything just shut off. I don't know if he lost electricity, if his kids' music broke something. I don't know what happened, but he's gone. And I don't have the voice to carry this podcast today by myself. Otherwise, you know, I would. But so I think that's going to be it. I'm going to wrap it up for now. My voice is already given out. I've hung in for as long as I could. I hope you guys appreciate all that. Keep an ear out for the new podcast, PHP Alive and Kicking, as well as Scott Kick Warren's Community Corner. Subscribe to the audio podcast. They'll all be here on this YouTube channel. Even the pre-recorded of Alive and Kicking, we'll get those posted on here as well. And eventually that will also be a live stream. And we'll try to get that on an established date and time. I will say that can always be a little flexible. It's good to have an established day and time. So if people want to be on, they kind of know when they can be available. But when you're having guests on your podcast, you have a tendency to be more flexible because you don't know where they're at in the world and when their availability is. So we'll be working on that. Looks like I got John back just in time to say goodbye. Hey, John. You're muted. There you go. I got you. Nope. Still can't hear you. All right. I'll try to hold your attention for a few minutes just so John can say goodbye. I don't think it's going to happen. No, we don't hear you.
That'll be better.
There you go. Right.
Yeah.
What happened?
Just a quick power flash. Like everything just turned off and came right back on, except for my...
To the whole house or just your office?
I think the whole house. I'm not sure. But my battery backup that is up here doesn't work anymore because once the power flickers, I have to turn that on, even though I got to check the battery on that.
I actually unplugged mine because it was always saying that the battery's low. Like the battery wasn't holding a charge anymore, so I just got rid of it.
Yeah, I'm about to do the same because I don't know if it's happening often where there's just a quick power surge and then all of a sudden it turns off, but that mainly just controls all my electronics up top, which are my internet, my Raspberry Pis, and that stuff. And then All of a sudden things aren't working and I'm like, oh, I wonder if it's that.
Yeah, I thought when I got the batteries on the house, the solar batteries, that would like supersede the need for a UPS, but it doesn't. So the weird thing about it is if the city stops pushing electricity to the neighborhood, the house runs off battery, but there's like this moment, like a 30 seconds of the house shuts down and goes on battery solely, which is weird because it runs off battery anyways. Like right now, as we speak, I'm running completely off battery, but the house knows that if it needs to, it's getting electricity from the city. And if that electricity goes away, even if the house is already running off battery, it does like this little hiccup where it stops everything and says, okay, I have no power from the city, so I'm only running off battery moving forward. And I don't know why it does that, but it does.
That's dumb.
Okay, that's it. I think that's... We're going to wrap it up this week. Thanks for watching us. Catch those other... Keep an ear out for those other podcasts. And that's it. You good?
I'm good. Thanks for watching.
Bye.
This has been PHP Podcast, the official podcast of PHP Architect, the industry's leading tech magazine and publisher focused on PHP and web development. Subscribe today at phparch.com to see what the leaders in the community and industry are talking about.